your fans to take us away, controlled by the device. You're going to have a messaging sent from one device to the other, but actually all of those devices could have their own messaging module with pre-programmed message just for use for security or whatever you want. Or you want to find out if it's a flood coming. There are plenty of application for it. It's free band, it's free of use, and it's $27, $28. Come on.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of interesting technology, and as I said before, I'm sure Adafruit sells a whole bunch of LoRa-based circuit boards. Some of them can be hooked up with Arduinos and Raspberry Pis, and if you learn to cobble together a little Python programming, you might be able to build some fascinating gadgets. But they're short range type of technology unless it becomes complicated into some kind of a mesh network, as opposed to, you know, when other people think of amateur radio, they think of ultra long distance. And this technology is primarily line of sight, which, you know, gives you some benefits and then gives you some costs. So, you know, you never get anything for free.
I was thinking about even if you have a multi-family house and to rentals, you could have so many applications from frost control in front of the door to the sidewalk control to the opening of the front door control. I mean, this temperature control for the apartment, you could see that because it does have a messaging. So in other words, and the messaging doesn't come on the, some kind of a weird small screen. You could have your laptop. You could have your Android. You could have your Palm tablet. And that would be the part of it. And there is no need to connect any wires to it. You just use the Bluetooth. I mean, not Bluetooth, the Wi-Fi of that device. And how much you can buy the tablet for? $60. It doesn't have to be sophisticated. So there are plenty of applications you could use, and you don't have to ask anybody for the license, and you can extend indefinitely that network. In the areas when you have no cell phone, you could actually extend it, that network, to some limited applications and to actually.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting technology there, and what it requires is someone to fathom the nuances and come up with the software and hardware solutions and share it with the rest, be it a consumer design or an amateur radio guy or a maker type of person publishing. I think a lot of us already sort of use Bluetooth in that way. I mentioned, I think it was last Sunday, that I had put together a little EchoLink system for my other club. And as a push-to-talk button, I have a whole bunch of different ways of hitting push-to-talk buttons for that EchoLink. One of them is a Heil trigger key. That I've figured out how to get my computer to think it's a key press. But another one was a Bluetooth device. I press a button that's about the size of about three quarters stacked on each other, and it does push-to-talk utilizing Bluetooth technology. So, you know, a lot of the technology in a slightly different form is already there, but it's always good to have an extra one out there. It just requires people to sit down and think it through and come up to solve the problems, because every technology has benefits, but it also brings its own set of problems.
Yeah, it just popped to my... Okay, so there are plenty of applications, but just popped to my mind. Okay, let's say you have a family members and you have a vacation house, and you don't know who is in front of the door. So, actually, everyone from the family members could send the text message. The text message could even automatically open the door, because they have let's say, Mary, John, or whoever. Those are recognized by the network. Or they could send the information to the guy, to whoever is on inside, and it could show on the TV, because the Wi-Fi of that TV then is connected to one of the small modules in within that network that you created, and you can, you know, who you opening the door. You don't have to interrupt yourself watching Netflix. And to Xia.
Okay, you should try and get a job at Apple. You could sell some of their technology. To a degree, the problem is that that kind of situation sort of been solved. At least, anyone who sits at a dinner table with people with the cell phones, it is not unusual for people, rather than to tell you something, to SMS you using their cell phone to your cell phone. So these types of communications, with, of course, the help of the cell towers or local Wi-Fi connections for some cell phone technology, is already kind of doing that. The Internet of Things, as Chris mentioned, is alive and well and living among us. Eventually, Samsung is going to talk us into getting a refrigerator that orders milk when it sees that there's not enough in the refrigerator. They've been trying to sell that for a ridiculous price for at least 10 years that I'm aware of. Eventually, I'm sure it's going to be a staple in people's home in one form or another.
Yeah, we could go humoristic. But no. The difference between messaging between phones is that you have to pick up the phones and hear the beep. And then you have to put your password, and then you have to look, go to the menu and go to your messaging and see what the message is. It requires you to spend your time. With that small, inexpensive device, you don't have to do anything. It is connected. It has its own network. It's not interrupting you or your Wi-Fi or anything else. And you decide that let's say, your laptop in the living room or your TV has its own Wi-Fi connected to that network, right? Like you connecting any device that is connected to Wi-Fi. You have that least of those things. And now, when somebody sent a text message from his phone that is linked to the device, and he doesn't have to have the device. He has just his phone. He's in front of the door or not far away, 3 miles away from it. Let me jump. And he sends the message. And whatever the message is, redisplaying with you doing nothing on your TV screen. Because it's a messaging that is not connected to your cell phone network. And to Xia.
Okay, Wesley, but I could find you technological guys selling stuff that would promote the idea of the Internet of Things, of everything being cross-connected. So it's not that you need a separate device for any of it. Everything does everything. Almost everyone at this point has a cell phone. I don't know. Maybe I'm spoiled. My iPhone looks at my face and opens it up. If I have a message, it comes up the front of the screen. I just touch it, and the message just shows itself. So, they're making the strongest case for ease of use. Separating them to different technologies might be the opposite direction of where technology might be going. I mean, I wouldn't know. It's not like I predict the future. I usually don't listen to people who predict the future, because about 100% of the time they inevitably get it wrong. Otherwise, we would have loads of flying cars today.
Okay, I think we said enough about that. All of the links you have, so you can post them on your webpage, If you think it's interesting to anybody else, and thank you very much, and to next year.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Thank you for your presentation tonight, and I hope everyone enjoyed it. I'll be picking a couple of links, because, let's see, your email sent me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, the 13. So my webmaster would probably beat the whatever out of me. So I'll try and find one or two of the most important and put it on my link page, which is always is roy.ac2gs.com. Once again, I'm AC2GS, and this is the Limemark Technical Net. If you have any technical questions, and it's 9:13, so we'll open it up to general science questions. If you have anything you want to discuss about science or aspects of medicine, once again, we do not treat or diagnose over the radio. But if you want to mention something and see what we can talk about, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
J2GJE.
Yes, Ed, what can I do you for tonight?
Evening. I wanted to tell you about a documentary that's coming up, being shown in the Bourne Mansion in Oakdale. Would you be interested?
Certainly.
The name of the documentary is called Invisible Threats. Well, that means nothing. It's about the German wireless station that was built in West Savile in Suffolk County in 1912. It was shut down about 1917 when we got into the war. It's being shown Friday night, November 12th at 8 p.m. for the first time. And tickets are available through the TeslaScienceCenter.org. If you have any questions, I'll gladly try and answer, over.
Okay, if this is a documentary, is it going to be shown on some streaming service at a later time? I would assume so.
At the moment, it's only being shown on the big screen. It's very difficult for a video photographer to get something, let's say, onto the History Channel. This is the first showing. I guess based upon the interest it brings by having different people there, it might eventually make its way to something like the History Channel. But the idea is to get paid for it after putting a lot of money into it, over.
Yeah, I can understand that. I just kind of thought that, you know, people are still a little bit wary of coming together in movie theaters. You know, even Dune kind of did not quite get as much of an audience as it probably would have if it was released in a time that people weren't anxious. So what place are they showing it again? November 12th at 8 p.m. Give us the location for people who would like to attend.
A2GJE. It's being at the Bourne Mansion in Oakdale. I believe it once was the home of the LaSalle Military Academy. But tickets can be reached through the Tesla Science Center. And the seating, I believe, is 500, but they are only selling 250 tickets. Or at least they hope they can sell 250 tickets. They probably will be every other row and every other seat. They've been trying to show it, but with the pandemic, this has really put it off. This has really, really been a problem in trying to bring out this new documentary, over.
Yeah, I could understand it. Like I said, I mean, it kind of clobbered Hollywood in general in the last 2 years. Most people still feel not very comfortable going out and getting together, so it's a problem. You know, nowadays, though, there are so many financial commercial streaming services looking for material that, you know, it's not like I'm an agent or anything. I can't get them any deal. But there's got to be some company out there looking for material. I mean, not only all the streaming services of Paramount Plus and Disney Plus and Netflix and you know, probably five or six others, but there are internet-based technology, documentation, scientific research oriented commercial streaming services that provide this type of entertainment and obviously pay people to obtain it. So I hope that these people are able to find some kind of a distributor to kind of make a you know, at least make their money back.
K2GJE. I'm not involved in the selling of it, and I don't make any money by advertising it. I did some sound bites for the film, and I did some technical advising for the film, which was very, very interesting. It's a very, very involved story. They were able to reach Neuen, Germany on a continual basis, which was sounds almost impossible for the time, and there were spies involved and a connection to the Zimmerman telegram, a connection to the sinking of the Lusitania. Is a very, very involved story, and in the making of the documentary they found so much other information. They have enough to make another film. This film runs a little over, I think, 75 minutes. This film runs 75 minutes, but the thing is getting funds. They did get funds from the Lion Gardner Foundation to make this. Over.
Okay, well, I certainly wish them luck. So anyone out there listening to us chat, it's the Bourne Mansion in Oakdale. It's in Visible Threads, and it's going to be November 12th, 8 p.m.
Just information.
Yes, Wesley.
A week ago, I believe 2 weeks ago, we've been talking about the Mars laser connection system. I got the email from Paul. I think Paul might give more detailed information about it. It's a contract for $191 million that is signed for it. And to actually.
Well, you know, Paul might want to address that during his SpaceNet report.
That's correct.
WS2N. I really don't have additional on that, by the way, Wes. I was just giving you an update on what I had found. I like to find at least two articles before, you know, talking about it. Back to you.
Thank you for that.
Oh, okay, and if anybody's listening, what we were talking about was last week we were discussing the possibilities of what NASA would like to eventually do is just be able to transmit a laser beam all the way from Mars to Earth, and by doing that, we would actually be able to send even video. You can't really do that, you know, with RF. That's the whole story. Anyway, back to you, Mark.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Once again, this is AC2GS. Anyone out there with any science questions? Well, I was going to ask if Frank had any questions, because he was on Echolink, and he mentioned last week that he would bring them this week, but he seems to have fallen off of the Echolink app. Hopefully he'll be coming back soon. But anyone else out there, if you have any science-related type of questions, topics, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name.
KD2, Victor Hotel Delta, Jim.
Yes, Jim.
Hello, Roy. Nice job. Very interesting information about the Bourne Mansion presentation. Radio began here on Long Island, and I'm very, very looking forward to this, trying to get there. It sounds very interesting. And secondarily, I was wondering if Paul had any new insight into the Shackleton Crater oddities.
Oh, okay. No, nothing new on that. I didn't see anything new on that. I thought about what we discussed last week. So we're going to know an awful lot about it in the next couple of years once they start landing. They're going to start landing the rovers there, you know, Viper. China wants to go there as well. So we're going to know something about it. Give it a couple of years. We'll be digging ice out of the thing and creating water and oxygen and hydrogen out of it. Just kidding. I think that's a long way off, but that's the goal. Back to you.
Thank you. It should be interesting. Looking forward to it.
Yes, Wesley.
Last week we were talking about hydrogen cars. I don't want to really go to that, but some additional information that I found in the meantime. So we had previously combustion engines, and then the hybrid was introduced, which was half electric and half combustion, and then it was using fuel and charging the batteries, and the batteries could be used if there was no fuel or low fuel. Then the next stage in the Moore's Law progress was the engine that was electric, and that was Tesla. And the next one was hydrogen electric. Hydrogen combustion. The next one is hydrogen electric. So for 5.5 kilograms of hydrogen, you could have 1,350 miles from the single fuel, and it would be 5.5 kilograms of hydrogen. And one of the responders in the forum asked me a question. Well, what is the pressure in those tanks? And how dangerous it is to have those tanks in the car. I did some more digging and I found out that they have been done, those tanks are built from the reinforced fiber. In comparison to the metal container that could be a little bomb, this one, when it cracks, it releases the hydrogen to the air. And of course, we have the water vapor as the only effect of this car pollution, if there is a pollution. Right. So, I would expect that a Tesla will soon face a strong competition from Japanese who are promoting the hydrogen car because it does give more mileage, and the cost of the 1 kilogram of hydrogen right now goes at 20 cents
but with the additional cost of getting it, it goes to maximum to 97 cents per kilogram. Now think, a simple mathematics. We're talking about 5.5, 5.7 kilograms at max for the car and 1,350 kilometers of range. Well, the 1,500, that range would go approximately to 1,000 miles per charge. And that would be 5.5 times around $1. So for $5.20, we have 1,000 miles from the car. I didn't see any reaction from the electric cars, from the Tesla or anybody else, but it looks like the technology is going there. So just simple information. What do you think about it, Dr. Roy?
Well, I wish them well. An extra technology is always better than one less technology. As I've mentioned before, and I don't want to beat a dead horse, the devil is in the details. Electrolysis production of hydrogen is not incredibly efficient. There have been all kinds of catalysts designed to augment the inefficiencies of electrolysis. And then transportation, and then maintenance, and storage, and risk. At one point, you kind of mentioned if it cracks, it just kind of releases. Well, yeah, but hydrogen gas is a volatile, explosive material. As long as your atmosphere has no oxygen, you're fine. But on Earth, we got lots of 20% oxygen. So that mixture release can lead to a big boom. Yes, the byproduct of combustion of oxygen and hydrogen is very safe water. It's not the reactants and such. It's the reaction that troubles me. And you know, if it goes boom, a lot of people are going to get angry.
Well, reinforce the fiberglass. I believe was chosen not because they don't have a metal for it, but because they thought about safety. 1,000 miles for $5.50, that is something. And there is a model Toyota Mirai that 2021, this year, that goes to 1,350 kilometers or miles. I'm not sure. I'm kind of confused. I believe kilometers. 1 kilometer is 1.7. I'm sorry. 1 mile is 1.7 kilometers. So that is to be checked out. But that is unbeatable. Absolutely unbeatable. Enter action.
WB2EAP.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, I just joined the net, and I heard you saying, Roy, how you're worried about the explosiveness of hydrogen in a 21% oxygen mixture known as air. Let me just say, consider the other side of the coin. Gasoline, I believe, is even more dangerous. And remember, the standard of reference for hydrogen dangerous is the Hindenburg. And, you know, most of the people survived. It was the gas bag that made all of those beautiful flames. The hydrogen basically burned above the dirigible.
Okay, but, well, there's a whole bunch to unpack. I think, in retrospect, a lot of people are suggesting that it wasn't the fact that the Hindenburg had hydrogen gas. That it had a whole bunch of other design flaws that led to the fires that it sustained, and the hydrogen just didn't help matters much. You have a large concentration of very volatile, explosive gas that when it starts to leak, it actually heats up instead of cools down. I don't know. That worries me much more than a tank of gasoline. that if you get a leak, it just kind of dribbles down the bottom, maybe. So it's a combination of the volatility, the energy storage content, and the fact that it kind of spreads rather quickly all over the place. So I don't know, you might be right. It might be a lot safer than gasoline, but there's a lot of people concerned that it might not be. And you know, the worst thing that could happen for a Tesla or any electric car is when there's a lithium fire, you know, that goes on in those things, because those fires are god awful when people videotape them. They're scary as heck. So, you know, you got to think of public relations. And I don't know. I just think that unless we discover some kind of really nifty way to store it that doesn't entail incredible pressures and such, I think we're going to have a problem with it, firstly. But who knows? I don't predict futures.
I agree with you totally, Roy. I'm just saying, I don't see where it's any worse, gasoline or lithium battery fires. I'm just saying that it's a three-headed hydra.
PhD, coming.
Yes, Jim.
And they should definitely be explored, just like we explore and experiment with things in the radio. The problem is that most often when they're presented with totally unrealistic cost analysis. Totally, absolutely off the wall, not truthful. Hydrogen is great, cost a fortune to make. Electric drivetrains are superior, but storing electric is expensive and filthy. These are great ideas, and we should pursue them and experiment with them, but way too often they are pie-in-the-sky estimates of their costs.
Yeah, but if we take into consideration that Mirai, M-I-R-A-I, Toyota, the highest temperature it goes to is the temperature of boiling water, if something goes wrong. There is no combustion engine, so there is no ability to, no chance to get the spark there unless there is a crush that does it. And those tanks are made from reinforced fiberglass. The Toyota has two tanks. All of the tanks have total of 5.5 kilograms of the hydrogen, and that's $5.5, roughly. $5.20. When you go below $1, that's the real cost of hydrogen for today. I remember the first microwave was $50,000 when it was built. And now we have a microwave for $20. So the cost will go down. But the benefit for the car maker is that people don't want to spend the money for fuel and to extra. Oh, but there is one more thing. No batteries. There is just one small battery because hydrogen makes the electricity, it's temporarily stored in the battery, and then it's powering the electric. So battery is like the interface. It's not really like a storage. Comparing to Tesla, that is full battery. All barum of the car is the battery. How do you think? And what do you think about it, Dr. Roth?
Again, I think new technology is great. I think they should put a lot of effort and see what it develops. I tend to agree with Jim that for the most part, when people are pushing some new technology, they're not doing it in an unbiased way. They're taking a kind of real rosy picture and they're optimizing all kinds of things, and almost never are the estimated costs realistic. Sometimes it's only twice, sometimes it's 10 times. You see it all over the place. You see it with Elon Musk regularly underpredicts the cost of things or the practicality of things. And you know, I've heard you repeatedly use the microwave oven as an example. It is not the general example. It is an extreme case that's very nice. If you take something like catalytic converters, you know, when there were only a couple of thousand, they did not scale up. Economy of scale doesn't work for most things. So when you scaled up the catalytic converters, they're still relatively expensive because they use rare metals. With microwaves, it was just the technology needed to be perfected. It's not a matter of just the technology being perfected with hydrogen. It's the safety issues, containment issues, and the general inefficiency of hydrogen in the real world picture. You know, maybe in a laboratory you could make hydrogen experimentally in small amounts for that type of a price. But when you start to manufacture tons of the stuff and then have to move it around different places, the price can escalate. So hopefully maybe it'll revolutionize transport. I don't know. But I do know that almost everything is not perfect, and you got to fix the details, the complications. And almost every technology has them. Sometimes they're extremely obvious, and sometimes they take a little time to show themselves. But nothing simple in this life.
The big hurdle is that until you can find another way to carry energy in a bucket, the complications make the costs astronomically higher.
I was getting the information based on the actual prices. So 95, 97 cents per 1 kilogram of hydrogen. This is the total price of the ready-to-use product right now. But the question is, Dr. Roy, I love your skepticism. That's the beauty of you. And but at the same time, if I make at my own lab nitrogen, liquid nitrogen or gaseous nitrogen, and I see it just going out, what is the big deal? Using exactly the same technology, I'm interested with nitrogen, but I could actually extract hydrogen. It's a sieve. Nothing more. The sieve is good for many years to use. You put no money into it. Once you created the sieve, when you have the sieve pipe, then you use it for 10 years. Doesn't change much. Enter XG.
AEC2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
Does he mean a sieve?
Sieve, it's... Fiber, it's a fiber porous substance, and because of the nature of the particles, you can have the high nitrogen going through and not able to escape, while the other particles of the air escape. But the same story is with the hydrogen generator. You could use hydrogen generator for what? $500? The industrial one or the lab grade one? If you're interested with it. It does have a sieve too. So it's not there is a difficulty in it. I believe the Moore's Law will allow that technology to get cheaper. What actually amazed me is $5.20 for 1,000 miles. Nobody can beat it. And no batteries. You have just one battery that you like that is used in Mirai like an interface. So again, the car that goes, yes, I see it, 1,350 kilometers, which would be about 1,000 miles, a little bit more than 1,000 miles. Toyota MIRAI. Right now is in sale. Enter XGF.
AC2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
Wesley, are you talking about molecular sieves? Please clarify.
That is correct.
All right, it's not called a sieve, it's called a molecular sieve.
Okay, thank you very much for correcting my English.
I don't care about your English, I just clarifying the pronunciation. And I do think it's incredibly naive to think that it's that simple to make hydrogen and to utilize it. I think that, you know, no battery is, again, very naive. I'm not trying to be insulting. I'm just trying to be practical.
It's the matter of interpretation of the information. You can go and you can check it out. I would love to agree with you. Are you giving me the homework? So far, I have at my my lab, I have a nitrogen farm, which is made from multiple devices. Each one is standalone. So I have a clean air or zero air is being called. Then I have a gaseous nitrogen generator, and then from that it goes to the liquid nitrogen generator. So the set of all of the devices gave me liquid nitrogen. I've been doing it for quite a long time. I was working on it. I was repairing it. And I do thank you very much for correcting me. You have your opinion. I have my opinion. The next week we can meet and we can discuss. Or I would appreciate if you tell me the basis for your skepticism. And to extra.
No. We can meet and discuss it, Wesley. I'd be very pleased actually to meet you again. I very much enjoyed our first meeting. But to make your own nitrogen, to purify nitrogen, and to liquefy it is fantastic. And I think it's a mature field, though. And however practical it is to have your own access to it, you know, we buy the tanks by the several thousand liters, really, all the time. As a matter of fact, every day. To keep our NMR machines and our samples cold. So no, I wasn't criticizing you in any way, Wesley. You should be rest assured of that. But yes, we should meet again. AC2PL, return to net.
WS2M, question.
Yes, Paul.
I'm wondering how Wesley gets the gaseous nitrogen to a liquid form. That's the question. How do you go from gas to liquid? You know, that's usually done with cryogenic system.
Okay. The gaseous N2 goes to the Dewar, which has a Peltier pump that is operated with helium. So in other words, think about a Dewar, which is like a bucket. On the top of that bucket, you have a Peltier cooling pump with the cold finger. The cold finger is actually extended rod made out of copper. That rod is being cooled by the helium compressor. When the gaseous nitrogen gets close to it, it liquidizes and goes down to the bottom of the Dewar. And then when the Dewar that is 35 liters of the liquid nitrogen is full, the sensor is launched telling me that no more. And then the helium compressor switches off into XGS.
But you separate the oxygen first, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe you would be able to explain it better because see, you have much better English. Would you please?
That again. No, you explain it perfectly, but you have to separate the oxygen first and the water.
Oh, no. That's right. That's right. You're absolutely right. But we're talking about me delivering to the gaseous nitrogen generator zero air that is being called zero air. In other words, it's air, but it's clean. No water, no moisture, no nothing. Just pure air. So I have a separate device that does give me a pure air. So there is no motion, no vapor, no nothing. Now, this thing is delivered to a gaseous nitrogen box. It's not the box. It's like a small refrigerator. And this one has those, what I call sievers. Those actually, they're actually pipes with the filter in it. And then, after that, I have a gaseous nitrogen in the pure form of it. And it's a lab grade. Now, that gaseous nitrogen in its clean form goes to another box, another refrigerator. It looks like a refrigerator. This one is Japanese. It was made for SEM, the electron microscope. I have had few of them in history. Right now I have one, and I'm buying another one with the parts to the third one right now because I've got a good price. Let me drop. So the quality of liquid nitrogen for the SEM microscope, electron microscope, must be extremely, enormously high end, very, 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 very high. So that's what I have. And to XGA. Dr. Roy.
Okay, AC2GS. So basically, it is a cryogenic method to condense the gaseous dry nitrogen to a liquid form and then store it. I just want to unfortunately rain on some people's parade. Moore's law really isn't the law. It's just an observation that an engineer made many years ago about how semiconductors are advancing in density over each 10-year interval. That's sort of slowed down now. You can't really use it for anything other than the present state of semiconductor design. I would love there to be a Moore's law for battery technology. There isn't anything close to that. Battery technology is a very slow crawl. So almost all the other four fields of science do not have the dramatic, almost exponential increase and improvement that solid state electronics has had. I mean, I recall when I was back in the 1980s, I saw a hard drive, a 2 megabyte hard drive for $2,000. You can buy a 16 terabyte hard drive for $500 today, and it just gets cheaper and cheaper. But you can't use Moore's law for hydrogen or energy or batteries, certainly.
Yeah, I think there are no more questions in this area because there are no guys having ideas for the subject of conversation. I can go to something else.
Well, let me throw it out to the rest of the guys out there. If they have something that came to mind, I was still looking for Frank on Echolink because, again, last week he wasn't able to give his questions, but he apparently stepped away from Echolink. So let me first ask other people. If there's no new people with new questions, we'll go back to something that you'd like to bring up. Again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. If there's anyone out there with any questions or comments, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Hey, Jim, and AC2T.
Yes, what can I do you for?
Yeah, very good. Thanks for hosting great discussions here. I learn a lot every time I listen. I was just curious about helium. You know, I work a lot at Brookhaven Lab, and helium seems to be a subject that comes up all the time, you know, about scarcity. Meanwhile, people are still blowing up balloons in Party City. And I hear the Chinese are looking at the backside of the moon to harvest helium. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the difficulty of extracting helium and why it might be on the back side of the moon. Hi, hi. AC2GS NV2T.
Okay, very good. We sort of touched on it last week, but I'm more than happy to go back there. Helium. Helium it has an interesting history in general. Helium was not discovered at first on the Earth. Helium was discovered in spectroscopic studies of the sun, which is why it got the name helium, from Helios, the sun. So originally, at the very beginning, when people sort of knew about helium, they didn't have really much experience with it. Helium, nowadays, on this planet, there's no native helium left. If it's open to the air, it rises to the very top of the atmosphere and diffuses out into outer space. Primarily, our stores of helium come from the radioactive decay of radioactive materials in our Earth core, and the gas slowly percolates up to different pockets. Caves that are sealed up sometimes are a source. Natural gas facilities often have helium mixed in with the natural gas that are separated. So there's a lot of different sources for helium, but it is not a renewable resource in the short haul. It takes millions of years of the radioactive decay to produce a sizable amount of it. So it's a scarcity in that there is a non-renewable amount of it. We're not quite sure how much total we have, but if we run out, it's very difficult to make up for it. So that's on the planet Earth. So you still see people using balloons, and as the price goes up, there'll be probably less and less balloons. They'll have to pay a lot more money to run superconductors with it. So that's earthbound. Amusingly, helium is the second most abundant element in the universe. The only thing more abundant is hydrogen. Right after the Big Bang, the idea is that when protons kind of finally caught electrons about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, you had hydrogen and there was some cross-reaction and a significant amount of helium and a little trace of lithium. So that was what the early universe was like. So if you could go out and scoop it up, it's very diffuse, you would have an endless supply of helium. Let me drop for a sec. The story behind the Chinese and going to the moon for helium is not actually just for helium. It is for a special type of helium, helium-4. The sun produces helium-3 and helium-4. Helium-3 tends to get through a little bit. Neither of them really get through much at all. So we're stuck with the radioactive decay helium, which tends to be helium-3. Helium-4 can possibly be used for fusion reactions. It has a lot of scientific use. So the value of the isotope helium-4, which is in very small supply here on Earth, would be worth a king's ransom. The idea that people had was to try and figure out the most expensive thing that we need that we can get from the moon. And that they rationalized that the helium-4 given off by the sun in solar flares and such can stick to the surface of a non-magnetized moon and be mined from it. So that's their rationale. They figure they could get the most money per gram for a substance in helium-4. So that's the story of mining helium on the moon.
Oh, very good. Very succinct, very clear, and perfectly understood. Must have a tremendously wide background. I've been listening to all the subjects that you're knowledgeable about. Oh, man. So listen, thanks again. Love listening, and especially via radio, you know, it's kind of exciting. AC2GS, NV2T, to the next question, sir. Thank you.
Some addition.
Yes, Wesley.
Not that bad as you think. The global demand for 2010 for helium was about 30,000 tons. That was at that time about $1 billion. Well, we're talking about twice that money today, probably. Maybe not. What is the inflation rate? Anyhow, not that bad. It depends from who is interested with what. There is the process technologies for the helium recovery from natural gas, and Russia has those pipelines. They newly built Northern Stream 2 at the bottom of the Baltic Sea to avoid Ukraine, and is directly going to Germany right now in process of certification, and with number of protests may not go as well. But anyhow, the conventional process used for the recovery of the helium from natural gas examines the potential emerging technologies for more efficient helium production process, and that was in South Africa. There is a good in helium-rich gas reservoirs. Russians, they don't care. They don't care. And that's the worst things. They don't care. But anyhow, the amount of helium in the gas looks like small, but it's huge. So the extraction of helium from the gas sources shows that it is 0.05 of the percent of helium that has been found economical and feasible for production. A 71% of the global helium production plants are accounted by the United States, Algeria, Qatar, Poland, and Russia. The 21 nuclear power plants, which what you mentioned, is another way of getting helium, with 150 reactors and some under construction, will require an enormous amount of helium for cooling systems in near future. So, as in my lab, in plenty of labs, helium is extremely important. So far, I didn't have a problem to get it. In my helium, in my liquid nitrogen generator, I have right now the low pressure, so I cannot make liquid nitrogen till I get the refueling with helium. Okay, so we have natural gas composition, which is 30 to 90% of methane, along with light hydrocarbons and other gases forming along with the natural gas. That's what we could use, and that has inside the nitrogen, hydrogen, sulfide, water, carbon dioxide, and traces of heavy metals. So we are not aware that in our kitchen we might have those traces. The H2 10.2% of helium is in the crystal gas composition. That is from Tanzania, Rukwa, and the Virginia microbial gas, Virginia, that would be United States, and of course South Africa. They have 4% and probably 10% of helium containing reserve, with the remaining gases being methane, and mostly small amounts of water vapors. So those are the information that I can give you right now. It's not that bad. 10 to 8 years.
Okay, Wesley. Like I said, we have more than enough that we can abuse it and use it for birthday balloons. But it's troublesome that we're not really aware of exactly how much we got, and it's not particularly renewable. You can't really produce a heck of a lot of helium even with nuclear decay. You need a planet to decay.